Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Program 26 for March 29th, 2007. Conestoga is Oklahoma's largest literary science fiction and fantasy convention. And now it's time for an interview with author Jody Lynn Nye, recorded at Conestoga 10, one of the special guests brought in to help us celebrate the triple 10 anniversaries of Conestoga, Misha Merlin, and Yard Dog Press. We're recording again at Conestoga. This time I have the author, Jody Lynn Nye, who is a Misha Merlin author, so she's helped to come celebrate Misha Merlin's 10th anniversary along with Yard Dog Press and, of course, Conestoga. And I want to thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, Jody, when I was doing a little bit of research, I was looking at some of your books on your website, and I noticed that you are involved in the mysteries of Robert Aspirin, which I read a number of his books a long time ago, and I certainly want to continue reading the series. It's just, you know, it's been a long time since I've read them. And how did you get involved in collaborating with those?
Bob and I have known each other for a long time, but the connection actually goes back farther than that. My husband is Bill Fawcett, have been friends for many years. They got together on a business project some years ago. They hung around at conventions together for many years. He and Darwin Bromley, Walter Barrick, and a couple of other people had done some business together. Bob stood up at our wedding. But before that, Bill took me up to visit them in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He and Lynn Abbey were married. They lived in a nice little house on a nice little cul-de-sac, and they were incredibly gracious to a stranger who was very, very nervous to meet two of her idols. But they couldn't have been nicer. At the time, there was absolutely no concept that Bob and I were going to work together.
Okay.
But as time went on, people kept pushing us together because we both write humor. And they kept saying, oh, well, you know, you would just absolutely be naturals together. And the two of us, who are very independent and very individualistic, would sort of look at each other. I've likened it to circling cats.
Uh-huh. Kind of like Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin.
I hope not. There's a chemistry there that I really wouldn't want to duplicate. But Bob gave me the I've got a rep to protect thing, and I've said I've got a rep to protect too. And in the end, we worked on a book together called License Invoked, which we did for Bain Books. It's a story about music, rock and roll, spies, and all set in New Orleans. Of course, long before it was blown away.
Uh-huh.
We had a lot of fun doing that.
Have you thought about doing a post-Katrina sequel? Or could you?
I would have to go down there and see what's left and how things are changing. But it was mostly about the characters. New Orleans was definitely a character in the first book. Because we had one agent who was with the American CIA's version of the Magic Department and the British agent who comes from MI5 Magic Department, acronym OOPSIE, I thought that the next one would naturally be set in London or somewhere that would be more her venue, because it was clearly the first characters, the character that Bob created, and I created the other one. That's frequently the way it is with collaborations, that one person will come up with one character that they'll run, the other person will come up with another character they'll run, and then we talk out the dialogue.
Do you find that working in a collaboration, it introduces a different dynamic into creative process?
Very much so. It means you have to do a lot more advanced planning, because you have to tell the other person what you're going to do, and you have to agree on a lot of division of labor. Mm-hmm. Who's going to be responsible for what dynamic. There's a great deal to writing a story, some of which also involves who's going to be in charge at the end, whose fingerprints are going to be the most evident. When I was working with Anne McCaffrey, I worked on her worlds in four different books and then wrote a sequel on my own for one of them. She was clearly the superior writer, the senior writer. Mm-hmm. And what she said went, although Anne McCaffrey is incredibly generous and frequently took my ideas, said, I like that better than what I came up with. She's marvelous to work with.
And what are some of the titles of the books? I know we can find them on the website, but we want to go ahead and list a couple here on the podcast.
The Death of Sleep, which came out as one of the Planet Pirates books.
Okay.
They are actually books that follow the Dinosaur Planet series.
Okay.
By Anne.
And what's the solo title one that you wrote?
I wrote one called The Death of Sleep.
Oh, okay.
The other two books were by Anne. and Elizabeth Moon in collaboration. Then there was Crisis on Duna, which followed Decision at Duna, which was by Anne Alone. And we also worked on Treaty Planet, which was also called Treaty at Duna, that made the third book in that series. Then there was The Ship Who Won, which is Anne's Brain Ship series.
Right.
Followed an entirely new brain ship called Carrie Al and her Braun Kef. And I wrote a solo sequel to that called The Ship Errant.
Well, we're going to talk about Strong Art Tactics in a few minutes.
Okay.
And then, but let's talk about Bob. I've seen Bob as a guest at OCON way back in the early 80s. So I imagine he's probably a little grayer now since I first saw him. It was well over 20 years ago. And he was definitely a character then. So I definitely want to hear how you work with Bob.
Well, once Bob and I got finished circling and deciding that we would work together, we have a lot in common. We have very many mutual interests. We have a similar sense of humor, really, but he has a different life experience than I do. We have different expertise. So it was up to us to divide out the work and to see who would do what best and who could accomplish what more quickly and who was more interested in doing which scene. The outline for License Invoked, for example, it's not even blocked out by chapter. Sometimes by paragraph, it would say A for Aspirin or J for Jody all the way down the margin with lines in between to delineate who was going to do what when.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard some collaborations that, you know, alternate chapters and they both go over it and make sure that it's consistent. I know some collaborations where one author does the bulk of the work, you know, one may just write an outline, the other one just writes the book.
Mm-hmm.
And they have their name on it.
I've done all of those kinds, every single one that you can think of, except for being able to sit side by side with someone and go line by line the way that Catherine Kurtz was able to with Debbie Turner Harris on the Adept books. They were able to sit together and work.
And since you've collaborated with a number of different authors, I guess it's like having a relationship with a friend,
mm-hmm.
is that each relationship is different. Do you find that there are similarities or differences in the way you collaborate with the other authors?
Absolutely. The dynamic depends. As I said, with Anne McCaffrey, what she said goes. With Bob, a little bit less so. I'm not at his level, but I'm closer to his level than I am to Anne's. And I'm starting to work with an author called Nick Pallotta, who has written almost 50 books, and yet we're considered equals, so everything is going to be 50-50 on this, and it's a lot different. I like the experience of all them. I learn something from everyone I've ever worked with. And as long as you keep respect for one another. And I think that that is the primary thing that you have to have, whether or not you personally get along with them.
Mm-hmm.
You have to respect them because what they're doing is holding your career in their hands. When a collaborative work is finished, someone has to go over it at the last and smooth it out, which is how you have one voice in a book instead of it looking like it was
okay.
written by two people. So yes, there's always somebody who has to smooth it out.
Mm-hmm.
Which one of you that is depends on the dynamics of the collaborative team itself.
Are you the one that gets to smooth it out, or it just depends on the book?
Largely depends on the book.
You recently came out in the fall of 2005 with Strong Arm Tactics, which is put out by Misha Merlin, which is one of our co-celebrants here. Go ahead and tell us what it's about.
My main character, Lieutenant David Wolf, has joined the Army. He wants to serve humanity and be a force for good in the world. He's one of those people who wants to save the world, but he's a political hot potato. His father is a don of a very powerful family. So the Army does not necessarily want him to get killed or hurt because things tend to happen. One of the things that the mob has done as it spreads out into space is become responsible for things like supply. And they're also very, very rich. So they control shipping lanes. They control entire space stations. And they have their own forces, if you want to call it that. It could be a big headache. They also have power in politics. So he has been put into a place where he is in charge of what has been the punishment detail, just to keep him out of trouble. The people
okay.
who have the least desirable quarters, the least desirable assignments.
Mm-hmm.
And he feels that this is an opportunity to raise their self-esteem, to bring them out of the detail and put them back into the force and make them proud of themselves once again. Well, they were getting along just fine without him. And they have their own ways. They have their own customs. They have their own quirks. And they're not entirely sure that they want to take orders from a wet-behind-the-ears young man whose first lieutenant bars are so brand new that they still have the plastic on them.
I think in the military they call those guys butter bars.
So they're handed a cream puff assignment, or what looks like one. Unfortunately, there's a rebellion going on at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And they are supposed to go to a world and retrieve an item created by an inventor who happens to be that world's equivalent of Walt Disney.
This is definitely sounding interesting.
His entire world consists of perhaps 8 cities, one of which is almost entirely this gigantic region-wide amusement park. And that's where a large part of the action takes place.
It just came out in the fall of 2005,
mm-hmm.
and there's a couple of books you're getting ready to come out with. I believe you mentioned the Mythgotten Games, yet another book in the Myth franchise.
That's right.
When is that going to be available?
This fall.
Oh, okay. And then there was also another book, you said, a start of a series, Unexpected...
Apprentice.
Apprentice, and that's going to be put out by Tor?
Tor Books, come this summer.
Summer of 2007.
Mm-hmm. It's the first of a duology, the second book. I had a pair of titles, but publishers love to change titles, so I can't tell you what the putative title of that one is going to be.
Well, hopefully it will meet your approval, but of course I guess that's really up to the publisher, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Well, when I was doing a little bit of research to learn a little bit more about Jody Lynn Nye, I am familiar with her name and her works, but I had to learn all the different titles. And when I was looking at the website, I was a little confused, and maybe other people might be confused, or maybe it's just me. She has another series that has the word myth in it, but it's the mythology books. And could you tell me, that's your own series, could you tell us a little bit about those?
This is another part of the result of never having intended to work with Robert Asprin in the first place. I have a series in which there is a young man who is a college student in Illinois,
mm-hmm.
and he believes fervently in magic. He's pretty sure that it's just out of his grasp. It's just where he can't see it, and he's absolutely right. It's right there on campus. The name of the first book is Mythology 101, and all of the subsequent titles have had the word mythology in them, mythology abroad, higher mythology, and advanced mythology. And the subsequent ones will also have mythology in the title. So when the time came that I started working with Bob, naturally there was a bit of confusion. We both have what are essentially apprentice wizards of various kinds, but mine is set in this world and his is set in a fantasy world,
mm-hmm.
where people who look like us are called clods because they come from a dimension called Claw,
mm-hmm.
whereas mine is a college student called Keith Doyle who goes to Midwestern University, which is not exactly in existence in Illinois.
But it sounds like a real university, though.
Oh, it has all the problems of a real university, including college politicking, kids playing practical jokes on each other, sorrow in love, too much homework.
Yes, very typical. I work in a university, and it is an interesting environment to work in. One of the things that I want to know about, I'm intrigued because you have a far more experience in this, and I would appreciate any advice. You worked in television, and what did you do in the television industry?
I was in television for 4 years. I had intended, like most people who went to film school, to end up in production. I ended up in the tech department. I was the technical operations manager when I left. As a matter of fact, I was in on station construction from the very beginning. We started with empty rooms and a lot of cardboard boxes. I was under the auspice of a man who had built many stations in the past, and his task was to make a high-powered UHF station in very little space with astonishingly little money. But he was brilliant at design, and he came up with a very clever way of making sure that the antenna system could handle the signal, in spite of the fact that we had about half of the room we should have had for it.
For either just the space of the equipment or also for heating and cooling?
The heating and cooling was also an adventure. We had one day in February 1983, which was the coldest Chicago has ever had. I think it was February 24th, when the thermometer temperature hit 27 below zero, but the wind chill hit 84 below. It's the coldest day Chicago has ever had.
Wow.
And I was up in the transmitter tower of WFBN, which was Channel 66, trying to keep the heat exchangers from freezing.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was my very own real-life adventure.
I worked around two-way radios and base stations, so I know a little bit about heat. How it can be a problem. Just a little note. 10 or 15 years ago, our KTUL Channel 8, someone forgot to turn the heater on, and their tower iced up southeast of Tulsa near Coweta, and it collapsed.
Ooh.
So they were off the air for a little while. They've since rebuilt it, but the ice, I said, was several inches thick on it.
The problem was not our antenna. The waveguide that fed the signal up to the antenna was also a creation of our chief engineer. It was half-height waveguide, but it carried the signal. The problem was the klystrons, which are inside each transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
And these are gigantic vacuum tubes that weigh 75 pounds each.
Much bigger than what you find in your microwave oven.
And cost tens of thousands of dollars a piece. And replacing one was an incredible hassle. So I was trying to protect these things from going out.
And of course, you don't want to be in the path of a wave guide. Not that you could, but you'd get cooked.
Well, they were all in the ceiling. That was not a problem.
Oh, yeah.
It was the transmitters. You didn't want one of these things to blow up near you.
Yeah, considering how much power goes through one of those.
Mm-hmm. We're a 2.5 megawatt station.
What kind of transmitter radius was that? I guess that covered the whole metro Chicago area and then some?
It was supposed to. It was supposed to get all the way out to Joliet, Illinois.
That's actually quite a ways, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
How far did you actually get?
Ah, that's a problem. We were frequently transmitting on as little as 10 to 20% of our supposed broadcast radius.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Well, were you able to get into the cable feed so at least people that had cable could get the station?
Oh, there was no cable to speak of when I was there. I was there in the early 80s.
Okay. Well, I don't want to betray your age.
Go ahead and guess. I don't care.
One of the things I noticed on Jody Lynn's website is that she is a cat lover. And I've had cats in the past. We've talked about snakes. We've talked about dogs. We've even talked about birds as well. We're going to talk about birds in another podcast as well. And so I think I want to give Jody a chance to talk about cats, since we seem to have this animal thing going with some of the podcasts. Our lead up into cats is going to be, since she's worked with Bob Asprin, she came up with the list as how to tell Bob from Jody. How did that come about?
Well, we keep getting this thing of, I don't know which one you are going to be. We both have Lynn as our middle name. And obviously, we both like to write humor, and we both have myth in our title names, but we are two different people. It's not just one person out here doing this work. So I had a humorous list that you can tell the difference between us because Bob is tall, and I'm short. He's male, and I'm female. He's dark-complected. I'm very light-complected. We do both have brown hair and brown eyes, and both wear glasses. Bob smokes. I don't. But we both love musical comedies or musicals of any kind, and we both break into song at the drop of a hat. Please don't drop any hats right now. I don't want to sing on microphone. And we both love cats. Bob at the moment is writing under the one cat system, but I'm writing under the two cat system.
And how do those differ?
Well, as Dave Barry said about his two dog system of writing, I have an emergency backup cat who will come in and harass me should the main cat be unable to perform. So Bob has to rely entirely on Princess, his Himalayan. I have two cats. They're called Jeremy and Miles. Jeremy is far too intelligent for his own good. He's the one we're going to send to MIT. And he worries about things. And he figures out how to get into things or how to do things. And he knows how to internalize a rule, except in the case of mourning doves. We have a screen porch that you can see the deck out from outside it. Mm-hmm. And Jeremy will go entirely lizard brain. His entire higher functions of thinking go completely out the window when he sees a mourning dove. Obviously, something in his primal urges says, that would be very, very tasty. And he will splat himself on the window trying to get at the bird, even though most of the time he knows glass is solid.
Uh-huh. What kind of cats are Jeremy and Miles?
They are Heinz 57 variety. Jeremy is a genuine Texas longtail. He came to us from Teresa Patterson, who lives in Arlington, Texas. When one of our cats was gravely ill, when we lost her, Teresa said, you probably aren't ready yet, but we have the kitten for you. So my husband flew down to Texas and brought home this kitten who was alive, alert, happy, lively, interested. But he's a little on the shy side. When Cassandra was ailing, we got a kitten so that Jeremy would have company. And we didn't want him to have another shy cat so the two of them would be skittering away from each other. We got one with an assertive personality, and that's Miles.
Is Miles a vocal cat or just assertive?
He's just assertive. Neither of them talks very much. Jeremy used to come in and complain that the dishwasher was running and it hurt his ears. Other than that, he hardly ever says anything. You know that there's a crisis if he actually speaks.
Do the cats interfere with your work? I've noticed that when I work on when I had cats, they decided that keyboards were their natural enemy and that they had to protect you from them, and they would get between you and the keyboard.
I have to deal with the 1,000-pound chin. That's where the cat climbs into your lap and gets all cuddly, and then because it's so handy and at just the right height, puts its chin down on your wrist and holds it in place, which makes it very hard to reach for anything without disturbing the cat. And how can you possibly disturb the cat?
Yes.
Reproachful glances all around.
Well, I developed this theory that cats have variable gravity attenuators in their feet because mm-hmm. when they climb on your chest, they feel like weigh 10 times more than they really do. But, you know, I could be just nuts.
I think we're all nuts about cats. We won't get up to discombobulate them when they've decided it is time to sit on your lap. My cat Cassie knew 10 seconds before the phone rang that the phone was going to ring and would settle in on your lap and cuddle up and go to sleep. And then the phone would ring, and you would be faced with a sleeping, comfortable, happy cat and the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
They control our lives, and I don't really mind.
I've noticed that, you know, in owning cats, they all have their quirks. And one of the quirks is the different kinds of food they like. Do they have anything that's unique that they like? Because I had a cat that liked cantaloupe for some bizarre reason. But do you find that your cats have a particular tasty dish that you wouldn't expect them to like that they might eat?
My first cat, Midnight, liked butter toast and pretzels, and loved scrambled eggs. Lila liked hamburgers, especially Burger King. And Cassie would just kill for chicken, any kind. When she was ill, she preferred raw chicken. And naturally, you want to keep them away from raw chicken. But when she was ill, the doctor said, give her anything she wants. So she was having diced raw chicken breast every day. These two, they prefer cat food. They really do. But they like to experiment with plant life and will try out all the cut flowers or vegetation that we have in the house. And if they don't like it, they usually leave it alone. But they like things like rose leaves.
Do your cats tend to be indoor cats or outdoor cats?
Always indoor.
Indoor.
We live in a heavily wooded area, and there are a lot of wild animals out there. And I'm not so worried about the wild animals because the cats will run for their lives, mm-hmm. as I am about things like fleas and ticks.
Yes. And very important to take good care of your pets. And indoor cats have a tendency to live longer than outdoor cats.
Our first two cats we used to take outdoors to roll on the sidewalk and eat grass and stare at birds. But when we moved house, we put the kibosh on any outdoor activities at all. And they just took it as read that in the previous house there was a big outdoors that was part of the house. And in the new house there wasn't any outdoors.
So they weren't testing you to try to figure ways to get out?
No. They were pretty good about it. In this, which is our third house, we have the screen porch, so they have outdoors without actually having any of the problems, including mosquitoes. It's even screened underneath the floor, which is a really brilliant invention. Mm-hmm. Because we have a mosquito problem, we are yards from a marsh.
Yeah, that could be definitely a problem, especially if they decide they want to go for a swim. not intentionally. You know, being a cat lover and a cat owner, do you find that they inspire your work, or do you find them working their way into your writing, or are they or can they be a distraction to the actual creative process?
Oh, I find them an inspiration. Cassie and Lila were both mentioned in a story called Purr Power, which I wrote, about a general who needs to evacuate a city because the Hittites are coming. It's set in ancient Egypt. And the priest of the Temple of Bast absolutely refuses to evacuate because he has a way to help.
And where can people find this story?
It's in A Constellation of Cats, which is edited by Denise Little. I think it's still available. It was a terrific anthology.
I will, and when this podcast is over with, I will put show notes, of course, a link to Jody's website, and I will try to list at least where you can find those books if they're harder to acquire. Did you want to tell any more about that particular story? Or
I enjoyed writing about mm-hmm. Egypt. I am very interested in the culture. I think that if anybody wants to see something that is alien to the way that our mindset is now, the life of an Egyptian in that period was not really that of an individual, but of a cog in a very organized machine. Everybody had their purpose, and I think that could be very comforting in a way. It wasn't that you were condemned to be a slave, but that was your purpose in life. If you believed in the gods, then they had put you there in that lifetime to fulfill that function. And I think it's kind of interesting to have attributed all natural functions to different gods. You could blame a particular god for thunder. You could blame a particular god for bad crops, somebody to appeal to.
What about bad breath?
It probably was a god of halitosis. It would be the foul wind.
I'm sure we could think of some other gods, but we won't go that direction because we want to keep this a family-friendly podcast.
I always think of Board of the Rings and Rosie Flanneled Aurora, she of the flannel tongue.
Well, my favorite bit of Board of the Rings is that opening sequence, you know, you must have me the ring. And it's just an excerpt. It's not even in the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm. In other words, it was morning.
Yes, obviously, you know, it's definitely a teaser is what it is.
Mm-hmm. That was a brilliant book. Of all of the parodies I have ever read, that is probably the best.
I would have to agree with you on that. She's been a very wonderful guest. She's been very patient with me, and I really appreciate that. Now, when you are working on a piece of fiction and you're doing research, how do you go about doing the research? And do you find that as you start doing the research that people find out you're writing a book and they go, I want to help you, or do you have to pry information out of people?
I don't usually have to pry information out of them, but I have to find the right person to ask. For example, when I was writing one of these stories that I set in Egypt, which was called The Voice of Authority, it's in Pharaoh Fantastic, which is edited by Marty Greenberg, and Brittany Corin. I went online to try and find the sources for the information on the coronation of a pharaoh, the investiture of a pharaoh. It would have taken me, I cannot tell you how many months, to find all the information that I needed to, but I got on the phone with the archivist for the Oriental Institute of the University of Chicago, whose name is Chuck Jones, just like the animator. And when I told him what I needed, he said, come down, because I have a couple of books which I think will give you all the information that you need. So instead of having to mine through the enormous library that the Oriental Institute has on Egypt, mm-hmm. he was able to put three books in front of me. And then while I sat there, he got enthusiastic about it and plopped four or five more down in front of me. And I had the ability to also browse through the library and take copious notes and photocopy if I needed to. So in an afternoon, I had what would have taken me 6 months on my own. People are my best resource when I'm researching.
Is there a danger in doing too much research and not writing the book?
One of the biggest favors that my first fiction editor, Brian Thompson, ever gave me was never air your education. No more than 10% of anything that you garner as research should appear in your book or your work. The rest of it should be implied writing from that knowledge, not putting it in. There's a lot of people who feel, by God, I suffered to get this and you're going to suffer too.
Yes, I unfortunately have read stories like that.
It's not fair to the reader. It's not fair to you, because anything that appears in the story must make the story move along.
Info dumps are, I know, a big danger. One author that I really enjoy, who's actually at this convention, Glenn Cook, he does not do an info dump, but when you've read a chapter, you somehow have absorbed a tremendous amount of information, and I think he does an excellent job with giving you a lot of information without making it seem like an info dump.
There are ways to work in a great deal of information, but as C.J. Cherry says, you don't want to visit the reader with a cold, indigestible lump of exposition. It really puts a damper on what could be an exciting story, especially when you and I don't think about how electricity turns on a light. All we do is flick the switch and the light goes on. The same thing goes for somebody who is steering a starship. They don't say, all right, you know, put in reverse thrust to the engines, do this, do that, 10,000 different instructions later when all you need to say is reverse course. Everybody else is going to do their job. And if for some reason the gizmo that makes the ship turn around is the thrust of your story, then you can explain that, because that is your MacGuffin, that is your point of interest. But don't bog the reader down with something that doesn't make the story move. If they lose interest in it, and they will, you have failed yourself and them.
Do you feel that in writing a shorter work, you obviously can't do the info dump, but with a longer work, you can probably get away with a little more exposition without losing the reader?
Only if it's necessary.
Only if it's necessary.
You cannot believe how many times I've had to throw out incredibly wonderful things that I've come up with because they didn't fit, because there was no way to put it in without boring the reader to tears. If there was a way to say, here is this culture, here is this wonderful ceremony that they have, if it's not part of the story, it doesn't belong there. It's happening on another channel. You know, if you want to watch Discovery Humanities, that's fine, but, you know, we're here on the Adventure Channel right now.
We don't want a travelogue. I read Victor Hugo's Les Miserables, and there are whole chapters of exposition of the Paris sewers, and this is not what you want to do. It was interesting from a historical perspective, but I can see why some people, they would just want to skip over that.
The period was different. The taste for literature was different. It was their television. Drawing huge lyrical pictures of what they were, what surrounded them, what life was like, was drawing a picture for them that they literally would not otherwise have. We have the opportunity to show people our worlds, but we have to show it from the perspective of our characters. If that perspective is too limited, for example, to describe the wonderful world of London of the 1840s, We have to do that outside of the knowledge of Oliver Twist, who as a 9 or 10-year-old boy would know nothing of this, absolutely nothing, who came from a workhouse, who was born in poverty, whose mother died giving birth to him. You have to draw London so that we understand more about it. But from his point of view, he knows less, so we have to know more.
that's something that hadn't occurred to me, and that's definitely an excellent point when you're reading a book that's especially set in a different period. Now, are you talking about as in when Charles Dickens wrote the book to the audiences of the day, or are you talking about a modern writer writing about that particular period?
I would say that you got away with more exposition. We have more personal stories now, and particularly in science fiction, they tend to be point of view stories. Instead of thematic, we tend to have plot-driven, so they are from the point of view of certain numbers of characters. And you have to limit the number of point of view characters you have, or you completely blow the mind of your readers. This is not War and Peace.
Jody, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I appreciate you taking the time today or coming here for me to interview you.
No, it's been fun.
And thank you very much.
Thank you very much for asking me. I've enjoyed it.
I enjoyed interviewing Jody Lanai, and I certainly recommend reading some of her books. Her most recent titles are Mythgotten Gains, co-written with Robert Lynn Asprin, and Strong Arm Tactics, which incidentally has a cover by our artist guest of honor, Don Mates. For more information about Jody, see the show notes for a link to her webpage. Looking forward to seeing you all at Conestoga 11, so thanks for listening until our next Conestoga podcast. For more information, our web address is www.sftulsa.org, or send an email to conestoga@sftulsa.org. Questions about our podcast may be sent to podcasts@sftulsa.org. Please send us an email or put a comment on the website and let us know what you thought of this podcast.